From Heterodox Academy. This is Half Hour of Heterodoxy. Conversations with scholars and authors. Ideas from diverse viewpoints and perspectives. Here's your host, Chris Martin.
Are we facing a free speech crisis in higher education today? According to my guest on today's episode, Jeffrey A. Sachs, the answer is mostly no. Jeff published The Campus Free Speech Crisis is a Myth, Here Are the Facts, on the Washington Post's Monkey Page blog in March 2018. And more recently, The Campus Free Speech Crisis Ended Last Year, on the Niskanen Center blog in January of this year. He joins me today to talk about this argument about whether there is in fact a free speech crisis. So let's start by talking about self-censorship as an indicator of a free speech crisis. Do you think self-censorship by students, whether it's self-reported or observed by other students, like assumed by other students to be going on, whether that's an indicator of a free speech crisis, so to speak?
I think it can be an indicator, and it can be an excellent indicator. What it depends on is the reasons for the self-censorship. There are all kinds of reasons that students offer for why they self-censor, whether in the classroom or outside of it, elsewhere on campus, that we might consider benign. Students, like all of us, want to fit in. They want to make friends. They might not want to appear foolish in front of people they want to impress. And students also sometimes don't have the right answer to a question, or they fear that they might have the wrong answer. When you look at some of the surveys that various organizations have put out, including Heterodox's surveys as well, and FIRE's surveys, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, these surveys show that students offer a variety of reasons for why they self-censor. And some of them, I think, are no more objectionable than I thought I might have the wrong answer to a question, and so I declined to say anything in class. I'm not certain whether those are the kinds of reasons to self-censor that we necessarily should be alarmed by or should view as problems.
When it comes to a breakdown by political affiliation, though, and surveys like the Knight and Gallup Foundation, you do see that students believe that conservative students need to self-censor their opinions much more than liberals do on college campuses. So there is some element of political ideology there being an issue.
Right, I think that's right. The Knight Foundation Gallup survey that you're referring to doesn't focus on classrooms in particular. They ask a broader question about the climate on campus and whether it inhibits student expression. So that's that kind of broader question. It certainly does show that there is a power of something we might call political correctness or certain kinds of expectations about speech that do inhibit students from expressing themselves, and that it impacts conservative and Republican students more than it impacts liberal and Democratic students. And just by the way, those same partisan and ideological skews are present to greater or lesser degrees in the classroom in FIRE's survey as well. So I do fully acknowledge, of course, there is this partisan and ideological skew, and I do think that that is something that we should pay attention to and we should think about. Again, I am very interested, however, in the reasons for self-censorship. Students, by and large, are liberal. We have multiple decades now of survey data from the Higher Education Research Institute out of UCLA showing the dominance of liberalism among students and increasingly the growing dominance of liberalism among students. So if we were to look purely at the role of peer pressure and socialization as shaping willingness to speak on campus, we would expect liberals, I would think, to be more comfortable expressing themselves and Democrats expressing themselves on campus than we would Republicans and conservatives. Now, I don't want listeners to get the wrong impression that this doesn't make me uncomfortable or that I think that this is entirely unproblematic. I just think that when we hear the term self-censorship, our mind leaps to a very worrying possibility of control and suppression of ideas. And I think we need to think a bit more carefully about what kinds of reasons for students withholding their opinions we're seeing, and whether or not those are reasons that should be indicative of a free speech crisis.
So in your opinion, what's a good survey question to use here, or should we use something other than survey questions?
Well, I think self-censorship is very hard to spot and measure and survey, but surveys do probably the best that we can do. By its nature, self-censorship is the kind of animal difficult to spot in the wild. So I think FIRE actually does have some very intelligent survey questions. They ask students, do you self-censor in the classroom? And a certain percentage, I can't quite recall what it is, do report they self-censor. It's something about 50-odd percent, or a bit higher than that. The vast majority of students report feeling comfortable speaking in the classroom, but a significant majority also do report that they have self-censored in the past. FIRE then follows it up with another question, why do you self-censor? And gives them a couple different options that they can choose from. By and large, again, the reasons that are given are issues of socialization. I wanted to look smart. I didn't want to offend my peers. I didn't want to seem dumb. I was shy. But a smaller percentage, just about 20%, do give an answer which I do think is a problem and does indicate an issue that we should care about. And that is these students who say, I self-censored in the past in the classroom because I was worried that my professor would give me a worse grade. And I think about that statistic a lot. When I first saw that finding, my eyebrows shot up, not with incredulity, because unfortunately, I cannot imagine students thinking that, but because of dismay. I think that's a real problem. There's no reason why a student should believe that just because they have a certain opinion, if they voice it in the classroom setting, they're going to lose points. Not unless it's a kind of speech that is so disruptive that it merits some kind of disciplinary action or something like that. But outside of those extremes, students shouldn't feel like they can't express themselves because they might be punished by the professor in their mark. And so I think FIRE very intelligently has this follow-up question where they ask these things. And that reason offered by 20% of students, offered disproportionately by conservative and very conservative students, that does make me concerned. Heterodox does have its campus expression survey, which I think the last iteration of that survey that I've seen on your website, Heterodox's website, was in 2017, I think in July of 2017. That survey does attempt to ask and replicate some of the same kinds of questions that FIRE asks related to self-censorship. And so it does, for instance, ask, do you self-censor because you fear you might receive a worse grade from your professor? And also, I think very intelligently, Heterodox's survey asks the reasons, like what kind of topics might motivate you to self-censor the most. And they're about what I'm sure listeners would expect. It's issues like race, gender, politics, that especially among conservative students seem to trigger the most reports of self-censorship. Those findings definitely make sense to me. I think that the fact that they replicate more or less the findings of the FIRE survey lend them a great deal of credence. Heterodox's campus survey, as it acknowledges, is not representative of the country as a whole. It doesn't use a representative sample. So I'm a bit cautious about using that data.
And as far as the question of whether the change occurred somewhere between 2012 and 2017, that's been a point that I think both John and Sean Stevens have made. And my indirect experience from looking at campus editorials suggests that's also the case. Mm-hmm. I guess I've been fortunate. I haven't felt like my ability to express myself either as a student or as an instructor has been affected. But the key point they're making there is that 2012 or so was the turning point. In your experience, is there any evidence towards that? I mean, I know you've been a critic of that.
Yeah, I'm a bit skeptical of the idea of this shift. So what can we say about this, the idea of the shift? I think that student activism seems to be more intense over the last 3 or 4 years than perhaps it was in 2011, 2010. Maybe one of the reasons I guess I'm a bit skeptical, to be perfectly frank, is because of my own experiences being an undergraduate during the run-up to and course of the Iraq War after 9/11, and also my own specialization is in Islam and Middle Eastern history and politics. And working in that space, you could see very clearly a lot of the same dynamics that that John and Sean and many others in Heterodox point to today. Pressures to self-censor, in this case, pressure to self-censor, or it, in the case of the run-up to the Iraq War, pressure to self-censor if you were opposed to the war, or maybe pressure to or skepticism or dissatisfaction with certain kinds of activism as being aligned with terrorism or aligned with America's enemies or so forth. There was a lot of pressure and a lot of the same dynamics back then that we see now. And I would, my intuition, and I'm still thinking this through, but my intuition is that we see a lot more continuity than we do notable disruption.
Okay, and which campuses did you collect this data from?
No, sir. This is, well, this is anecdotal data. I'm referring to my own experiences at in my undergraduate at University of Rochester, and then my master's at University of Chicago.
Okay, so there do appear to be a few other problems. For example, if you're an academic, people sometimes assume you're liberal, and they assume that you elevate social justice above other priorities, and in reality, people still have various priorities. Lee Jessam, for example, has a book chapter in his book, the book that he edited with Jared Crawford. I think that chapter has about 14 co-authors, some of which are centrist, some are liberal, some are conservative. And their experiences say that you're often assumed to have liberal opinions if you're in academia, and slightly stigmatized if it turns out you're centrist or libertarian or conservative. So do you think that's also not a new problem?
Well, I can't say if it's a new problem. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a problem that's gotten worse. I think that we would be foolish if we did not assume that if you're an academic, you are a liberal. If you look at the survey data, the vast majority, there's clear ideological and political imbalance among the American professoriate. I certainly don't dispute that there is a strong liberal lean and leftward lean to the academy. Now, Lee's argument, if I understood it properly, is that this damages the quality of research, that it distorts research agendas, it shapes the kinds of questions that are asked, the kinds of funding that is distributed, the kinds of manuscripts that are supported and promoted. John has contributed to that debate. I believe Sean has also contributed to that debate. There's a large body of work, and Heterodox is at the center of it, that makes the case for viewpoint diversity precisely on the grounds that the liberal lean is a problem because it distorts research. That's not an issue that I know much about, and so I'm very hesitant to kind of inject myself in that kind of debate. I guess I'm a bit more focused on the outcomes for students and the learning experience. But I can certainly understand that when it comes to faculty research and also public support for the academy, the absence of strong conservative voices might indeed produce a problem.
And when it comes to the situation in Canada specifically, there was a conference on campus free speech and academic freedom in Canada. Can you tell me a bit about what happened there?
Sure. This was a conference that happened just last week in Toronto. It was organized by the Canadian Association of University Teachers, which is one of our major faculty unions here in Canada. And it was a conference focused exclusively on the issue of campus free speech and academic freedom in Canada. And just like in America, this is a very live issue up here, made perhaps all the more acute in recent months with the decision by the government of Ontario, where most, or certainly a plurality of the universities are located, a decision by that government to require all colleges and universities in the province to adopt a free speech policy. One that would ensure that students and faculty have the ability to say and express themselves however they wish within the limits of the law, with certain you know, accepted time, place, and reason manner limitations. And then this is also tied to provincial funding. Institutions that fail to protect free speech on campus can find their provincial funding cut, which, because all our institutions are public, is quite a powerful threat. So it's a very live issue here. This conference was trying to explore, first of all, whether or not there is a crisis of campus free speech and academic freedom, whether it's a problem. Is it the kind of problem that government can meaningfully address? And are there ways of thinking about this issue that maybe are being neglected because they don't comport to what political actors and media seem to be interested in? And I think one of the really interesting things about this conference is that the language of crisis might be the wrong way to think about it, or at least the narrative of crisis might be distracting us from thinking intelligently about the issue. What really blew my mind, what really impressed me about this conference, were all the ways that free speech on campus might be compromised or threatened that we don't typically talk about. So, for instance, there was some fantastic work that was presented on faculty intellectual property rights and how the loss of faculty control over the syllabus through kind of the standardization of pedagogy via MOOCs and the digitization of pedagogy, how that might reduce the ability of faculty to control how they teach students.
So you're talking there about peer pressure from MOOCs or standardization MOOC videos that everyone has to use?
No, I'm referring here to, for instance, we have the same issue. We have a problem here of of the explosion of contingent faculty, where faculty have to, or people with very little preparation have to swoop in and teach a course. And how, as a result, they often take advantage of, already prepared course outlines and lecture modules and so forth. And often they face pressure from the department to adopt a certain kind of standard way of teaching and how this can erode the academic freedom of faculty. Fortunately, I'm not speaking from personal experience here, but it is something that seems to be a problem on some campuses. That's just one example, I think, of a kind of potential threat to academic freedom on Canadian campuses, at least, that I don't see talked about very much. And I found very fascinating.
Okay. So was there anyone representing sort of Lee Jessam's perspective there, the perspective that research is being affected, or was it mostly about teaching?
Well, we certainly had multiple faculty and speakers talk, I think, more about, what Lee Jessam describes as the liberal or PC lean to the academy. So an example, one speaker from, I think, Université de Montréal, described how in the requirements for receiving federal funding for certain kinds of research, you are expected to consult with stakeholders when they with whom you do research, and to afford them the opportunity to review and to help you interpret the research that's being produced. Let me be clear. This kind of stipulation that I just described was created specifically for researchers who are conducting research on Indigenous and First Nations Canadians. And if you're doing anthropological or archaeological or social science research on these communities, there's a goal in mind of giving them a role to play, not just as passive objects of research, but also as active partners in the research venture. And we had a faculty member, professor at this conference who pointed out, that's the kind of concession that we would never think to afford to a corporation. That if somebody was doing research on, let's say, genetically modified crops, and they were investigating Monsanto, we would never offer Monsanto the opportunity to review and offer interpretations of data that a researcher collects. And we would be shocked if somebody announced that they had done so for all kinds of perfectly valid reasons. And this faculty member was making the point, the speaker making the point that we should be more consistent, he says, in these sorts of things. So I think, that's the kind of thing that perhaps some of your listeners might recognize as a debate that we might have here, or you might have in America as well, regarding the power or the influence of quote unquote political correctness over the research process.
Right. I mean, that issue is not one that comes up a lot in social psychology, but it definitely comes up in anthropology in my experience, because I think anthropologists are very concerned about the effects of colonialism, but at the same time have to account for the fact that when you interview people, they're almost always saying things that are in their self-interest or trying to flatter themselves. So if they have the ability to censor your research or ask you not to publish something, it's probably because it's not in their self-interest. So that's a tension.
That's right. And certainly, I think, just to be clear, so that no one has any confusion, there's nothing in these guidelines, these funding guidelines that I just mentioned, that somehow give anybody a veto over in the publication process, other than the author, him or herself. But it gestures towards this principle of giving stakeholders, and I think at least implicitly Indigenous stakeholders, this kind of role in the process.
And on the issue of disinvitations, now jumping to a slightly different issue, some people think that's an indicator, and I actually have mixed feelings myself, because many disinvitations are either for someone very provocative, like Milo, who's doesn't have a scholarly background at all, or
right.
Disinvitations for commencement speakers, and that's a situation where someone is also being honored, so it's not simply a situation of whether they can speak, but whether they deserve to be honored. So I have mixed feelings about that, but I don't know what the situation is like in Canada and what your opinion is on what we should do about disinvitation attempts.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, more broadly, I guess, let me just quickly, disinvitation attempts encompasses, I think, what we typically refer to as deplatforming, but it also encompasses many other more banal things as well. FIRE, for instance, has a database of disinvitation attempts in the United States, and it counts and includes Milo, being chased off campus by a mob, and it also includes cases like that at Ave Maria College, where 30 alumni signed a petition asking the university to disinvite Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, from a speech. Those 30 alumni count as a disinvitation attempt, the same way Milo counts. So I think it's important for listeners to understand the enormous variety of what constitutes a disinvitation attempt in these databases. Now that said, you might think that any kind of attempt, regardless of how large or small, is equally reprehensible, and that's certainly one perspective. In Canada, we have no such database. We have a couple different websites operated by organizations that attempt to look at some of these same dynamics. I don't put any real confidence in these databases and these websites. I think that they are much more partisan and ideological than FIRE is, so I'm a bit skeptical of them. But I think again, this is anecdote, but hopefully intelligently derived one. Canada does not have the same number and frequency of disinvitation attempts that America does. And even in America, they're not very common. In Canada, they're even less common. We have had our incidents. People might be familiar with, for instance, Jordan Peterson's attempt to give a talk at Queen's University about a year ago or a year and a half ago, and an enormous protest gathered outside the building, pounding on the windows. I believe one protester is alleged to have even had a garrote, like something to strangle somebody with in her hands. Really, just incredible things. And we've had other incidents as well. So they do happen here in Canada. They are much, much, much less common, even when you account for our smaller student population size. And I think for listeners who are interested in this phenomenon of deplatforming disinvitations, that is interesting, right? Canada is a great comparison to make. We have a broadly similar student culture, all the same forces that are often identified as triggering this PC culture, this safe culture of safetyism, victimhood culture, whatever you want to call it, different terms, different phenomena. They all, I think, probably can be said to exist in Canada as well, to the extent that they exist anywhere. And if we have much less of this disinvitation happening here, that is a question mark. Why is that the case? And I have a theory, Chris. My theory is political polarization. My theory is so straightforward and boring. My theory is that what we saw in 2016 and 2017, this rash of disinvitation attempts and these big controversies, is much less about these broad cultural trends, which obtain equally well here in Canada, and are much more about the incredibly high levels of political polarization in the United States that are absent here in Canada. And I think that that might help us to inform the debate a bit about where this phenomenon is coming from and what might bring it to an end.
Now, if I understand correctly, though, Canada also doesn't have think tanks that are funded by large conservative donors. So there's not this industry of scholarship that's maybe somewhat reliable and somewhat not reliable. Is that correct?
Just so I understand, sorry, that Canada, you're asking if we have conservative funded think tanks?
Yeah. I mean, in the US, we have the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute. And so part of the situation here is that speakers from those institutes, well, especially the American Enterprise Institute, sometimes come to campus. And that's kind of a mixed bag because some of the people who do work there, like Norm Ornstein, for example, really do great scholarship. But then the institute itself was founded specifically to produce scholarship or white papers that have conservative conclusions. Do you have something similar to that in Canada?
Oh, certainly. We have, I mean, like everything else that America has, we have it only with less money and fewer in number. So we have, for instance, the Fraser Institute, which is based out of Vancouver. It often partners with Cato. Listeners might want to think about it as a bit more conservative version of Cato in its libertarian conservative fusion thinking. And we have other institutes as well. We have our own conservative think tanks here as well. What's missing is their engagement in the culture war in quite the same way. I do want to make one quick, maybe just to disagree with you a little bit about the American Enterprise Institute. I guess I don't see the American Enterprise Institute as one of the primary agents for this kind of thing we're talking about. And in fact, I was very pleased to see the AEI write a piece just not too long ago, maybe about 7 months ago, trying to persuade conservative students on U.S. campuses from inviting provocative speakers. I identify the problem much more as organizations like Young America's Foundation, which is where you'll be able to book. It's a, right. a speaking bureau for people like Ben Shapiro and associated speakers, or Turning Point USA, which does kind of offers a similar kind of a menu of speakers. Those are the organizations that have a very sophisticated outreach to students, whether conservative, libertarian, or just, you know, middle finger to the libs provocateur student groups. They're the ones that are reaching out and trying to get their people in front of college students, and also ideally in front of a camera where they can trigger an outburst. I'm not trying to make excuses for the outburst. I think that's where the source lies. That's what we're missing in Canada. We don't have our own Turning Point USA organization. We don't have Turning Point Canada. We don't have a Young Canadian, Young Canada Foundation with our own Ben Shapiro or Candace Owens.
Right.
So I think that's what's missing. And partly that's this absence of political polarization, and or at least less political polarization. And it's also because the university has not yet been identified or sucked into the culture war to the extent that it exists here in Canada.
Do you have any closing thoughts?
Oh, no. I mean, I hope, while I'm not a member of Hedrox Academy, I do think quite highly of much of what the organization does. And I certainly do... I don't want listeners to think that I'm dismissing or ignoring the difficulties that conservative students or other students might face on campus when it comes to expressing themselves. But I think it's so easy to overreact, and it's so easy to make bad policy during an overreaction, that we need to be very, very cautious with how we proceed. And I think all too often we don't see that level of caution.
Well, thanks for joining us on the show. It's been great having you.
Thanks, Chris. It was a lot of fun for me, too.
Toward the end of the episode, when we were talking about the American Enterprise Institute, I wanted to bring up the AEI's firing of David Frum. I didn't bring that up because I also wanted to move on to another topic before the end of the show. But Jeff and I chatted about it afterwards, and that firing was on my mind partly because David Frum is also from Canada, but mainly because David just appeared on an episode of the Bulwark podcast where he talked about that firing. If you haven't heard of the Bulwark, it's an online journal that's the home for many writers who were at the Weekly Standard, including William Crystal. And the Bulwark podcast is hosted by Charlie Sykes, who was the contributing editor at the Weekly Standard, and they release a new episode every day. It's a really good podcast. My next interview is with the clinical psychologist Katie Gordon, and we'll be talking about whether political expression can or cannot cause trauma in listeners. As always, if you have any comments about today's episode, you can contact me at podcast@heterodoxacademy.org or tag me on Twitter at chrismartin76. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on iTunes because it helps other people find out about the show. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is produced by Heterodox Academy. Find us online at heterodoxacademy.org, on Twitter at HDX Academy, and on Facebook.